Truma. Okay, so the first thing that we have to know is when they were told to take Truma for Bnei Yisrael, right, from every person you should take my Truma. So the Pasuk says, gold, silver, and copper, different types of wool, blue, purple, red, linen, and then goat skin. So, and this is the Pasuk we're really going to concentrate on today. The rams, the red rams, we're not going to concentrate on that. The oros tachashim, what the tachash is, we're going to use that last. And then the atei shitim. What was the atei shitim? So the first thing you have to look up is Rashi. Atei shitim, Rashi says, when it refers to these acacia woods, says ma'ayin ha'ilam b'midbar. Where did they get these woods in the desert? How did they get this wood in the desert? So Perish Rabbi Tanchuma, Medrash Tanchuma says, Yaakovinu tzapa b'ruach ha'kedesh. Yaakovinu saw with his ruach ha'kodesh ha'sidi Yisrael l'tzeis livnos mishkan b'midbar. Bnei Yisrael were going to build a mishkan in the desert. They and he brought cedar woods down to Egypt. Minatom, and he planted them. And he told his kids to take them with them when they left Mitzrayim. It's strange. Why wouldn't he just tell them to take wood when you guys leave? Just trust me on this one. We're good. He had to plant cedar woods down in Mitzrayim? Was that so necessary that he couldn't have done any, there was nothing else he could have done? And it's funny, the other thing is that Rashi repeats the exact same words later on in Chav Vav, Pasuk Tesvav. He says again, you should make it with cedar woods. And Rashi says again the exact same thing. Should be up, right? And it says, Yaakovinu nata arasim b'mitzrayim, k'shamei sivu labanu v'alosu mimam, and he told them to bring them up with them when they come out. K'shi yotzim b'mitzrayim, v'omelam sh'asir ha'kashbohu l'tzavu s'san lasos mishkan b'midbor, God is going to make a mishkan in the midbor, you're going to need this wood. Little differences, but it's basically the exact same medrash. We're in the same parsha. It's not like you could have forgotten it was a parak and a half ago that he gave the original translation. It's strange that Rashi felt this is integral to understanding what the Atei are. You have to know that Yaakovinu planted them in Mitzrayim, and we don't even understand that. What was he doing? Now, Yaakovinu himself, it's not only seeds that he took out of Eretz Yisrael that he planted in Mitzrayim. He planted actual cedar woods. Where did he get these cedar woods from? Where did he get these arasim from? Avraham Avinu had an eshel when he had his machane, when he had his ohel. He had an eshel there. The eshel, we all know, stands for achila, shtiyah, and lina, right? That's where his inn was, and people ate, drank, and slept there. That was what the eshel stood for, but it was this huge tree. Then the Amalek brings down that he used to bring his guests underneath the tree, and if the shade of the tree went down on top of that guy, he knew he was a good person, and he taught him brachos, and he gave him everything he needed. If the shade did not go down on top of that guy, there was no shade on him, then he knew that that person was not a good person, and he'd send him away on his way. He'd give him a little bit of stuff, and then he'd say, alright, get out. Now it's time for you to leave. That was the eshel. That eshel, that tree, was known as an ox, it was known as a cedar wood. That was the erez that was originally. Yaakovinu cut down the tree, but he didn't cut down the tree. How can he cut down such a tree, such a special tree? He uprooted the entire tree, and he carried it down to Mitzrayim. How is he so strong? I don't think I really ask those questions anymore. Yaakovinu fought with his 10, you know, the 11 shvatim. He fought against, you know, thousands upon thousands of people in all of our Canaan. I don't have any questions about that, but he took the tree, he brought it down to Mitzrayim, and he replanted it down in Mitzrayim, and he took seeds from that cedar wood, from that erez, that elah that was planted down and planted by Avraham Avinu, and he took the seeds and he planted other trees down in Mitzrayim, and it was all psychological. God promised Bnei Yisrael that they would come back. And he didn't want, he was afraid that his sons would think, or they'd say, we have no hope, we're never going to leave, how do we know we're going to leave, what are we supposed to do? Anytime they had, they said to themselves, we're never going to leave, nothing's going to happen, we're never going to go, they took one look at the trees. And Yaakovinu, they said, Yaakovinu planted those trees, Yaakov, our great-great-grandfather, planted these trees here, and he told us that when we leave, we're going to take these trees. They saw something in front of them. It wasn't just a guy who's going to come by and say, Pakot Pakanati, God is remembered you, it's time to leave Mitzrayim. It was more than that. They had a tree right there that was waiting for them as a simon, a davar mamashi, something right there in front of them that if they had any doubts if they were ever going to leave Mitzrayim, Yaakov, our great-great-grandfather, told us, we will leave Mitzrayim, there will be a gula, and that's what the Atei Shitim were supposed to represent. That's why it was so important that Rashi had to repeat it twice. That's how important the Atei Shitim were to tell them something. Yaakov Avinu wanted to be directly involved in this. So if anybody remembers the Gemara, Reb Chiya got into a fight with Rabbi Hanina, one of my favorite Gemaras in the world. Rabbi Chiya got into a fight with Rabbi Hanina. Rabbi Hanina said to Rabbi Chiya, what are you fighting with me? Oh, what are you doing? If the entire Torah would be lost, I'd be able to bring the Torah back with my memory. I have such a phenomenal memory. I would be able to bring the entire Torah back without a question, and I'd bring everything up. Any question that was ever lost, I would be able to figure it out. So Chia looked at him and said, "Well, you're fighting with me? I would make sure that the Torah would never be forgotten." I said, "What did Rav Chia do? How did he make sure that the Torah was never forgotten in the first place, that you need Rav Chia to bring it back?" This is what Rav Chia would do. Rav Chia would take seeds, and he'd plant them in the ground, and he'd grow flax. Then he'd take that flax, and he'd turn it into nets. Then he'd take those nets, and he would trap deer. Then he would take the deer, and he would shech the deer. He would feed the meat to orphans and people that were very, very poor. And then he would take the skin of the deer, and he'd work it until it became a cloth. Then he'd make his own ink, and he'd write a Sefer Torah on top of the cloth. When he finished the Sefer Torah, he would go into a city that had very young children. And he'd go and he'd give one of the Svarim, Bereshis, to one of the kids, a Shmos to another kid, and he'd tell the kids, learn all this. And then he'd take six other kids, and he'd teach them the six Sidrei Mishnayos, the six Siddarim of Mishnayos. That's what Rav Chia used to do. And he said, now I'm making sure that the Torah will never be forgotten. He told all the kids, you guys teach each other now. Everybody teach each other, I'm going. That's what Rav Chia would do. He caused that the Torah would never be forgotten. So it's the question that everybody asks in the Gemara. That could be growing nets for her. But it'd just be easier if he went to a store, bought a Sefer Torah, and brought it over to the kids. Just buy a chumash. Buy a little chumash, give it over to the kids, and teach the kids that way. But he had to ask, it sounds like the Chicken Little story. Like, who's going to help me bake it? Who's going to help me make the bread and do everything? It's just Chicken Little. That wasn't Chicken Little, was it?
It was the little hen.
The little hen.
Yeah.
What kind of hen was it? Do we know? Does it have a name? It doesn't. Chicken Little was one who said the sky was falling.
Yes.
Correct. Good times. So either way, regardless, it's just, why did he have to do all this? The answer is that he wanted to make sure it was all l'shem Shemayim. He did it all by himself. If he took some other net and he trapped a deer with some other net, there'd be a thought of something wrong, something else inside this deer, inside this chumash. He did everything here l'shem Shemayim. He even grew the seeds l'shem Shemayim. Everything was done in order to teach Torah to Klal Yisrael. And if you do that, the thing will never be forgotten. The Belzer Shoal. Everybody's seen the Belzer Shoal in Eretz Yisrael? The huge, huge shoal. The big white Beis HaMikdash looking building. The Belzer Shoal was not made. I can't tell you this for sure. This is what the word is. The word is that the Belzer Rebbe learned with Elio Anavi the halachas of the Beis HaKnesses. And he learned that there should be no hands of a Jew who's not Shomer Shabbos or Chas V'Shalom, a non-Jew, that touch the building of a shoal. The shoal should be made only by Jewish from Shomer Shabbos people. That's how it should be built. The whole thing should be built that way. Nobody else should be near it. I don't know if it's true, but supposedly that's how they made the Belzer Shoal in Europe, and that's supposedly how they made the Belzer Shoal here in Eretz Yisrael. What's the pshat? They get it from this story with Rav Chia. They get it from the Mice and the Gemara, that you're supposed to put everything you have into it. And that's exactly what it was over here as well. If you have something done l'shem Shemayim by a tzaddik, it's kadosh, it's Torah, there's no pasul machshavos, there's no bad thoughts that go into it. It's unbelievably done. So Yaakov Inu did it himself. He took the tree and he brought it down to Mitzrayim. He didn't want them taking just any tree. He wanted the tree that Avraham Avinu planted himself. That tree that showed him which guests were good and which guests were bad. He took that tree, brought it down to Mitzrayim, made other seeds from that, and he planted his own forest full of cedars. And he told Bnei Yisrael, when you leave Mitzrayim, don't take any other tree. Take my trees. I want you to take these specifically to be able to use for the Mishkan. Well, and that way the Mishkan will be done well.
Why did you have to bring down that tree? Why didn't you just grab the seeds from the tree and bring those down?
That's enough. Yeah, you could say that as well. Oh. There's one medrash that says that he brought the tree from Avraham Avinu. The other medrash says he just bought seeds and he planted it himself. You're right. That's the idea behind it. But if it was the Eshel of Avraham Avinu, meaning if it was that tree of Avraham Avinu, that tree was full of chesed. We all know if something is made with chesed, there is no way it can ever be destroyed. Chesed cannot be destroyed ever. And that's why the Mishkan was never really conquered. Sure, there were times the Aron Kodesh was taken away by the Plishtim. That was taken because Hophni and Pinchas took the Aron out to war and they lost the war. That happened. But the Mishkan itself was never touched by non-Jewish hands. There was no non-Jew that ever came and destroyed the actual Mishkan, even though the Aron Kodesh was eventually taken away. The Mizbeach, the Menorah, the Shulchan that was made by Moshe Rabbeinu, that was made by Bezalel, those Kalim of the Mishkan were never touched by non-Jewish hands because it was made through the Yisod and the Shorash of Chesed. That thing cannot happen. Okay, that's one. I'm sorry?
The menorah wasn't either?
Menorah wasn't. Not that menorah. There's a question if that menorah lasted in the Beis HaMikdash itself. What happened to the menorah? Is it a new menorah that was put in the new in the
Beis HaMikdash?
The Kalim from the Mishkan. Kalim from the Mishkan itself. These Arozim were undoubtedly special. But there's more to it than just that. I mentioned this a little bit long, a while ago. Shmos Rabba Lamed Hei Aleph says the following. Cedarwoods, arozim, non-fruit-bearing trees should not be in this world. They never should have existed. They shouldn't be here because our world doesn't get anything out of it. What do you have from it? You need firewood? You can use that from other trees. You have it from bushes. You don't need cedarwoods for anything. If it doesn't have any fruits, it doesn't have any nuts, it doesn't have anything on it, then what do you need it for? If you're not going to, what's it there for? You might as well just have more fruit trees. So the world should not have had it. The only reason why they were made, says the Medrash, was for the Mishkan and the Beis HaMikdash. For them to use the Mishkan, these Arozim that Yaakovinu planted, and by the Beis HaMikdash, the Arz Dei Lev Anon, the Arozim of Lebanon, that was the only reason why it was here. The greatest of all Arozim is Erez Shita. And that's called acacia wood. That's the acacia that I mentioned in your text. Acacia wood takes a very long time to rot. No matter how wet it gets, no matter how far down it goes, it's very hard for it to rot. It's very light comparative to other trees. It can grow anywhere, in any weather, wherever you go, and that's why it was used for crushing. Because it was the easiest thing to take down to Mitzrayim, where it's a desert-like area, and they were able to plant it very, very well. When they were chosen, these cedar woods, and they came with Bnei Yisrael, they sang to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Gotta love it when cedar woods sing. I've never heard it yet. But they sang to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It comes from something that we say every day. Tell me where we say this. Oz Yiraninu Kol HaSeyar. There you go. As you wanted to call it, we say it in Hodu. We also say it in our. We also say Hodu every day, and we also say it in Kabbalah Shabbos. Say in Kabbalah Shabbos. As you wanted to call it, the trees of the forest sang to HaKadosh Baruch Hu when they were used for the Mishkan itself. And that us is the lashon of Shira. Us Yashir. Us Anu Be'er La. That's the idea behind it. The Afe Shitim Omdim, Rosh Tevos, Ayin, Shin, Ayin. That's 440. The Gematria of Tum, for Yaakov, the Ish. Tom, who did it, and Shittim. How did they make it out there? How were they able to? Can you imagine traveling out with these huge cedar woods? It's Shat Yam. Shat Yam is that they floated in the sea. They went through the Yamsuf and they floated them down to where they needed them, right by Har Sinai. If you look at where they went straight down the Red Sea. They floated down the sea and then took them out of the sea to be able to use down there. The Drushas Ibn Shoab, I'm sure we've all heard of that saber, brings down that Adam took this from Gan Eden and gave it over to Avraham Avinu, and Avraham Avinu was the one that planted it, and that was given over to Yaakov, and he's the one who brought them down to Mitzrayim. The Shach brings down, this is the Shach HaLaTorah, not the Shach that writes on Shach, on Shulchan Aruch, but the Shach HaLaTorah, who's a Makubal, who lived in Tzfas, Sipsei Kohen, says, Atzei Shittim were named because they originated from Nachal Shittim, from the river of Shittim. Nachal Shittim is where Bnei Shimon sinned with the Bnos Midian and the Bnos Moab. They have a propensity to cause Znus. There are certain places in the world where Znus is more rampant. San Francisco would be an example of that, and because of that, it's a joke. Fine, all right, you got it. That's the propensity for Znus, and this is where the waters of Sodom fall came from. All the waters of Sodom came from this Nachal Shittim and traveled into Sodom. Now we know of that sea as the Yam HaMelech. We no longer have that river. The river is not with us anymore. But that's supposed to be what it's supposed to be. When Yaakov Avinu brought them down to Mitzrayim, he knew they'd grow there because there was Tuma in Mitzrayim, and there was Znus in Mitzrayim. So he knew these trees that were used to that type of water, that type of I don't know, growth would be down there in Mitzrayim. They were also, because they're so tame, they have the ability to become even more tahor, because the greatest tuma can become the greatest tahara. That's the concept. The Ibn Ezra asks, he asks the question, how are they able to leave with the huge boards? And he says we can accept it if we need to accept it, but as that, the Guriyah in Mizrahi said it's pashit. The Mitzrayim helped them. They knew they had to bring korbanos. They had to bring a lot of wood with them. So that's exactly why they were saying it. The Tevel Derech says it proved to the Mitzrayim that they weren't running away. They ran away. Why would they carry these huge trunks with them wherever they were going? It showed them, we're not running away. We wouldn't have done this otherwise. They weren't trying to run away. That was the concept behind it. Okay, that's the end of the Atzei Shittim. Proven. Okay, you all know this from what you say in Shema. It says, V'hayim shamoa tishmu. Tishmu al mitzvot. V'hayim shamoa tishmu al mitzvot. Hashem al kechem, right? It says, when you listen to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. right? What does it say in that? V'asapta digonecha. You will gather your own grain. V'sirushcha v'yitzarecha. And your oils and your wines. But that's bad. That's not what it's supposed to be, Lassadava. Lassadava, you're not going to work at all. When we listen to the mitzvot, and we're going to be rewarded, it's that things will be given to us. Not that we're going to have to work for our food. We're going to be given everything we need. Everything we could ever want is going to be handed to us on a silver platter. So why is it the asafta digenecha? Why do you have to work for your own stuff? It should be given straight to you. So I don't get it. What is that there for? That line the Gemara uses for that is the following. If you're doing osin ritzono shel makom, you're doing the ratzon of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, then you'll be given everything on a silver platter. You won't have to work a day for anything. Everything will just be handed to you. That's if you're osin ritzono shel makom. If you're not osin ritzono shel makom, if you're not doing what God wants you to do, then v'yasafta digenecha. You're going to have to work, you're going to have to gather your own grain. Now that's strange. That's not doing the will of Hashem? Okay, what about the Kruvim? When the Kruvim faced each other, when they were looking at one another, then they were osin ritzono shel makom, right? What happened when they turned away? Ein osin ritzono shel makom. It's the exact same phrase. Why is that called ein osin ritzono shel makom? What were they doing wrong? And how do you correct this? What does that mean exactly? What does that lashon mean? So we're going to use a muscle over here. Here's the parable. This is what the Nitziv says. A king feeds all of his workers. He gives food to everyone who works for him. He can't feed his entire nation. That would be impossible. There's no way. Unless you live in some communist regime where you're taking money from everybody. There's no way to be able to give food to everybody. But he feeds the people who work for him. He has two main categories of workers. There are workers who work in his palace. The guys who are his servants, his cooks, all the people that are around him. And then there are other workers that are his army men. The people who are serving as his guard and are serving in his army that surround the kingdom that are standing right there. Now, the servants and the maids and the cooks and everybody that works directly by the king who you'd think would be closer to him are not allowed to just stop and get food. They have to work hard for their food. They have to do something. The cook has to cook it. The servants have to serve it. The maid servants have to set the table. Everybody has to do something that revolves around the food itself. That's the only way they're going to get food. If they don't do their job, if for some reason the cook doesn't do anything that day, it's not like he's going to get any food. No, he's the one in charge of the food. He's not going to eat anything if he doesn't cook anything. If the servants don't serve it, he's not going to be able to eat himself. The king will get rid of him. Those people have to work for their own food. They have to involve themselves in the food itself in order to eat their own food. But soldiers, they just stand there. Granted, they protect, and sometimes they have to go out to war and they have to do things in war, but they get their food without ever having to deal with it. They're given it on a platter. They don't have to work a day in cooking anything. They're just given everything they need. The guards of the palace don't work in the kitchen. They don't serve the king. They don't get involved in that. They sit there and they guard the king. And when they're ready to eat, when they're done with their job, whatever it is, they go to the kitchen and they eat. They go to the dining room and they eat, and they're given any food that they want. So which one is greater? Which one of those people is greater? You can't really say. There are people that are closer to the king. The servants of the king definitely are closer than the guards are. The guards are not going to speak to the king as much as the servants are. That's for sure. But the servants have to work for their food and they have to work directly for the food, while the guards, they don't. Says the Nitziv. This is the concept. This is the concept of Bnei Yisrael. There are two ways for us to get food. Number one is for us to work hard with Avodah, which is Korbanos, or Tfilah, which is Davin. And we have to work not only within those things, but also to go out and do something. We have to have Yishtaglus. There are ways of being able, you don't just expect money to come to you. Even if you Davin all day and you bring Korbanos all day, you're not going to have money come to you. You're going to go out, you're going to work, and you're Davin is just a way. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, send me the right parnasa. Send me the right people, the right phone calls, the right anything. Whatever it is, send me the right contracts. I need to get this, that, and the other. And that's tefillah and that's avodah. There's another way. There's limud HaTorah. By learning Torah. By learning Torah, you're not working in any way, shape, or form. And this is a very rare form of getting money. But the idea is a person who's in the Melchamta Shel Torah, waging war for the sake of the Torah, acting as a guard for everything that HaKadosh Baruch Hu stands for, holding the Torah near and dear to him, that person does not work within his food. He doesn't work for his food or do something with his food itself. He just gets something from somebody else. He takes from somebody else, either because he's in kol and he's being paid to do it, or he just has bitachon in Hashem. HaKadosh Baruch Hu will send me something and that'll be whatever I need. I'll take care of it and HaKadosh Baruch Hu will take care of me. I don't have to do anything whatsoever. That's a very, very big difference. The Midbar, where Bnei Yisrael was while they were here, you know, working with the Mishkan, was a time when all they did was learn Torah. So how did they eat? How did they drink? HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave them everything. They had man. They had mun and they had a bitter so Miriam. They didn't have to work a day in their lives. These people didn't go anywhere. They just sat at home, sat in their tents. They walked outside every morning and they got everything they needed, pulled it inside. The mun fell on their doorsteps. The water came right up to their doorsteps. They took their cup, they took their mun, and they went inside. And that was it. They didn't do anything. They didn't work at all. They had nothing to do with food. The complaints that they had, "We want food again," were ridiculous. You had everything you needed. That's the level of a person, of the number two guy, of the shomer of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And then there's other people. The other people are the people that have to work for a living, that don't have that unbelievable bitachon, which is very hard to have in a world like ours, in which you just say, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to give me everything I need. You go out and you work for it. You have to do something. You have to work in some way, shape, or form in order to get everything you have. Says the Netziv, Peneim Ish Alachiv, the ultimate level, the level where the Kruvim are facing each other, where the world is, you're like a malach, you're an angel and you're being fed by a Kadosh Baruch Hu, is when you're learning Torah and you have nothing else to do. You are a guard of the king. And that's when they face each other. Ein Osin Ritzono Somakom does not mean you're doing a bad thing. Enos and Ritzon Shemalkam means you're not doing what HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the world for in the first place. It's not your fault, because the world has changed from what HaKadosh Baruch Hu could have it be. We have to work for a living. You have to do that. Enos and Ritzon Shemalkam is not a negative. It's another world. In that case, you're no longer Malachim. The Malachim don't face each other. And here's the Chiddush of the Netziv. They don't face each other. They face up. Their eyes look up toward Shemayim. They don't look at each other like this. They face up toward HaKadosh Baruch Hu and they beg HaKadosh Baruch Hu, give us food through our tefillah, through our avodah, and let us work so that we be able to get something. That's the pshat behind Shema. If you say B'chayim Shema Tishmo Mitzvah, etc., you're listening to my mitzvos. Ein Osin Ritzon Shemalkam, you're not doing what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants, because V'yasavta Digan Echo, you're still gathering in your grain. It's still not the perfect world. The perfect world is when you're given everything as a reward for what you've done your entire life. That's the concept. That's the idea behind what's called Osin Ritzon Shemalkam and Ein Osin Ritzon Shemalkam. And those are the two differences between them. And then we finally come to the Tachash. The Tachash. What is this Tachash creature? Oh, you don't get much better than this. Caution. Rashi says, Min Chaya, it's a wild animal. It was only there for that time when Bnei Yisrael were in the deserts. It says, "V'harbe gavanim hayula," and it had many colors to it. V'kach metargim sas guna shasas umisbayer b'gavanim shalo. It was happy and glorified itself because of all the colors that it had. It was so filled with colors; it was like just unbelievable. It looked different from any other creature that you've ever seen. The Gemara says that it has six colors. Sheish gavanim is how they darshan it out. Sheish gavanim altogether, six different colors that were there. Now here's the funny part: sas guna is an Aramaic word. Since when does Rashi retranslate an Aramaic word into Hebrew and say sas guna is really sus, as in being happy, begavonin, with its colors? Since when do you translate Aramaic like that? Maybe that's just its name. Do we ever translate anybody's name in Aramaic? Do you ever say that's the reason why it's called that way? Where does Rashi ever do that? We translate the Aramaic name and turns it into Hebrew. Here's the pshat. All animals were named by who? Adam Rishon, right? Their names changed into different languages at what point? By Babel. By Migdal Babel, when there was the Migdal, and the tower came, and everybody was scattered out to different languages, different lands, and they had different languages, and everything happened, right? So all their names changed. But if the Tachash was only created for this time, it didn't exist by Adam. It didn't exist by Migdal Babel. It only existed now in the desert. So how would there be an Aramaic word for a Tachash if it doesn't exist now and it didn't exist then? Why would the Aramaeans have a word for it? It doesn't exist. It doesn't have anything. So why is there a word for it? So Rashi looked at that and he said, it must be that Targum is not saying this is the name of the animal. He's saying this is the description of the animal. The description is Sasguna. It's happy about its colors. It's doing something about its colors. That's how it had an Aramaic name. It was a description, not an actual word. But there's lots of questions in Rashi. Where do you know it was a chaya? The Gemara in Shabbos, Chaf Chasam Aleph and Chaf Chasam Beis, does not say in the end whether it's a chaya or a behemoth. It asks the question, is it a wild animal or a domestic animal? And it doesn't answer it. The Yerushalmi does seem to answer that it was a chaya, but it's strange because our Gemara doesn't whatsoever. It's also very strange. What does it mean that it was only existing during that time? The wording of the Gemara is, Lefi Sha'a Mizgamin Lo Lamosha. At that time, it would happen to appear in front of Moshe Rabbeinu, and then it was Nignaz. It was hidden. Sounds like it was always around, but it was just in a crazy area, and then it became hidden. What happened? The Medrash Tanchuma says it a little bit clearer from Rabbi Nechemia. Maisin Nisim Haya. It was a crazy creature that you've never heard before. It was created just for that time, and then it was thrown out. Sounds like it wasn't existed before that. But how do you understand that? In Kol Chadash Tachas Hashem, guys, we all know, God does not create anything new under the sun. Everything that is here now existed beforehand. There has to be some type of prototype that existed by Bereishis. So what does that mean? So the pshat is, it's Chassam Sofer, he says in Nida, Nunawa from Abayz, it's also the Marsha that gives this answer, it's brought down by the Mizrahi as well. There is a Tachash that exists even nowadays, that exists even by us, but it's a Tummy creature. It's a tummy type of animal, and it's not something that you could use for the Mishkan, because the Mishkan could only have kosher creatures used in the Mishkan. There was a Tachash that was made that looks exactly like the tummy creature that was made kosher. It had split hooves, and it cheated God. While the other one didn't have that. The other one was not made that way. This one was kosher. The kosher one was made just for this time. The non-kosher one existed at all times. That's how it says in Yechezkel, it mentions in Yechezkel, that the an alcha tachash, that when you were in the Midbar, I gave you tachash shoes. Your shoes were made of tachashim. If it only existed for that one time to make it for the Mishkan, to use its skin for the Mishkan, how can you make shoes out of it? The answer is, it's okay. That was the tar one. These are the tummy ones. They're tummy tachashim. What is a tachash? What kind of a creature is this? I meant to bring it. I should have brought it. I should have brought the animal thing. The Yerushalmi in Shabbos brings down a name for it. It's called something like a tainin. I don't know how to pronounce these things. Or tonin. I don't know exactly how. The Korban Eda says that it refers to blue-dyed skins of goats. He says the same thing by the other opinion, but whatever. The Pnei Moshe says, no, it's an animal. This one is kosher, right? But the other ones are not kosher. And so too, Rabbi Nechemia says it's galkatinim. Galkatinim, again, is referring to some type of kosher creature that whatever over there. What does it refer to? So galkatinim, the Musaf Aruch, the Aruch, brings down the Aruch, which is a sefer written back in, I don't remember even one, but it's a translation to a bunch of words. It's like a dictionary almost, like the first dictionary says. It was a beautifully colored weasel. A weasel that had everything. So you can imagine, a non-kosher weasel, okay, that's granted, I'll give you that. This is a kosher weasel that was able to chew its cud and have split hooves. You had something like that that went everywhere. That's what this was. It was a kosher version of a weasel. But in the Bavli, it says a little bit more. Rabbi Nechemia calls it a tzla ilan. A tzla ilan is like a squirrel almost. So it would be some type of cat-like creature that would be there. If you put the two together and you take a weasel and you put it with a cat. No, flying squirrels are pretty cool. But it's not that. There's an animal called a genet or a kibbet. I think I'm pronouncing them correctly. I'm pretty good with animals. I was pretty sure, but I only read about them. Genets and kibbets are types of weasels that are a little bit bigger, that are half cats, half weasel-like creatures. They're not really in any real category. You can see them in certain zoos. You won't find them in Brookfield or in Lincoln Park here, but they do have them in San Diego and in Washington. So next time you go, I expect you all to check them out. But these are creatures that have like all these spots. They look like cheetahs or leopards. They have all these types of colors on it. And to think that there might have been a kosher one is a really cool concept. An unbelievable kosher cat-like creature that was existing in the Midbar just for that time, for them to be able to cut off the skin and put it on top of the Mishkan, for it to be that big. But I've always thought differently. Listen, in the original book that Rabbi Slifkin had in Mysterious Creatures, when he went through unicorns and he tried to explain it, this creature is supposed to have one horn in the middle of its forehead. He always said that it was a giraffe. It refers to a giraffe. The reason why is because giraffes, if you ever look at them, they have two horns on the side of their head, but it also has another horn right in the middle of its forehead. The reason why you don't notice that horn is because, number one, it's very small. Number two, who looks at a giraffe's head? Number three is because it's covered with skin. It's underneath the skin, but it is a horn in the middle of its forehead. So he tried bringing down from a Maram Shif that it's okay to have three horns. It just said that it has to have a horn in the middle of its forehead. It also has two other horns. The problem is that it's an obvious obvious question. I think he even asks that on himself. I'm pretty sure he does. If it's a giraffe, what's the easiest way to describe a giraffe? If you wanted to describe a giraffe, how would you describe it? The tallest creature you've ever seen before in your life? I mean, wouldn't that be the obvious way of describing it? If the Takash is never described as a tall creature, it kind of knocks out the giraffe completely. You don't have any idea. I always thought the following, and then I found it somewhere. I think Slipkin mentioned it, but I found it. It's just, I always thought there's a relative to the giraffe. There's only one living relative to the giraffe. It's called an okapi. An okapi, they just had a baby in Brookfield Zoo, so you can go visit. You'll have good times. This is the beauty of being a member of the Brookfield Zoo. They just had a baby over there. The okapis, they're in the African exhibit. So if you go on the other side, they're like where the bison are, and the giraffes, keep going, and there's like a little forest, that whatever, and you go in there, and they have them right inside there. Okapis are horse-like creatures, but they're related to the giraffe. The only difference between the giraffe and the okapi, in everything they have, is the neck. The okapi has a normal-sized neck, a horse-sized neck, instead of a giraffe-sized neck. The colors on the okapi are all over the place. The legs, the flanks, I should call them, are white and black striped, just like a zebra. The top of it is a dark brown. The underbelly is a light red. It's like a red that you can see, sort of like your shirt color, like that. This head has all these colors of brown and orange and red and white. They're all over. They're combined within this one little thing. And you look at the creature. These creatures are big. They're not huge, but they're big. Here's the crazy thing about these creatures. They were only discovered in the early 1900s. They live in this crazy forest called the Ituri Forest in the Congo, in the middle of nowhere, this huge, huge forest. And it took them years. They had no idea. It's the same forest, by the way, where they say that there's still dinosaurs living, and they're still looking for them. It's a massive forest. The forest is the size of Illinois. That's how big this forest is. It is a massive forest. And you can't go in there. It's dangerous because they have all these hippos and these snakes and everything inside there. It's not a forest you want to go into. But it's this huge forest. And in there, they finally found this one guy, found okapi at the turn of the century. Now, this creature could very well be it. We're talking about a multicolored creature that was beautiful. It's a clear, beautiful coat. It's something that you would call, it's been gunus. Nobody even knew about it. It's hidden in the middle of a forest. Somehow it appeared in front of Moshe Rabbeinu, and it's kosher. It's kosher. It has split hooves. It chews its cud. It's just like a giraffe in that way. You could eat it. In theory, you could shecht it. You could eat it. There's no problem with that whatsoever. That's what this creature would be. It's very possible that that's the idea behind what we're referring to. And I was always into it, thinking that this was the Takash, and that was the Oros Chashan that's over here. I don't really have a reason to say otherwise. The Gemara doesn't explain anything. And it does have, by the way, although it does not have horns, it does have that little thing right in the middle of its forehead. It sticks out right in the middle. It's not a huge horn. We're not talking about like a unicorn, like little thing that goes all the way out. That's not what it is. But it does have a horn right in the middle of its forehead also. It fits everything that the Gemara calls it. It's a chaya, but it also can be tamed very easily. It's a tame type of animal. That, I think, would be the best answer as to what you would call the Takash over anything else. If you want to look it up, go ahead. I'm sorry?
Who said that it was a tree animal?
It was a what?
Who said that it was like a tree animal?
Tree animal?
Yeah.
Oh, Tla Elon is what they call it. That's what Rabbi Nechemiah calls it. So you have a problem with something like that, but it could be that Tla Elon is not referring to an animal that lives off the tree, although literally Tla Elon means to hang off a tree. Maybe it's referring to eating the leaves off of trees. Absolutely no idea. Maybe that's what's referred to, because that's how okapis eat. They have huge, long, blue tongues, just like giraffes. You ever fed a giraffe?
No.
It's the coolest thing in the world. Yeah. It's the coolest thing. In Indianapolis, they have a zoo where you can feed the giraffes. It only costs $1. So you go ahead and you put it out. It's like freaky. Their tongues are the longest things you've ever seen before in your life. It just comes out, and you're like, you think it's a frog. And it's like these huge things. They go right down. They eat it out of your hands, and they put it in their mouths. It's the coolest thing. So that's where you can do it. In Tel Aviv Zoo, I still have a picture of me and Devora where it was illegal, but you know, everything's fine in Israel. You went up on this one little area, and like the giraffes all came to you, and these Israelis were feeding them like peanuts and like Coke, and like feeding Coke and like bowling around, and we're right there, and I started petting the giraffe. Then the zookeeper came by and said, "What are you doing? The giraffes are dangerous." And we have a picture of me and Devora petting the giraffe's head, going all the way around. They're the coolest creature. So copies, there's nothing like them. I suggest we all go to Brookfield Zoo tomorrow.
Yeah.
Rug with that.
Yeah.
All good. Yeah. I just got guys.